Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, that's one by Odyssey, and it's an oldie but goodie called Native New Yorker, and I just have always loved that cut, and so today's guest is from New York, so we'll be talking to him. He's from New York, so I thought it would be a pretty cool pun to actually have a song playing called Native New Yorker. But first, just some words of wisdom. I don't need you. I don't need you to pull me down and tell me what I cannot do. I don't need you uttering discouraging words in my ear telling me what I'm not capable of. I don't need you dropping salt in front of me, in back of me, pointing out my faults. I don't need you consorting with your personal opinions, summing me up as if you could. I don't need you to laugh at my expense, shooting down my dreams as if they don't matter. I don't need you pretending to be the victim when I speak up in my defense to stop you from tearing me down. I don't need you telling me what is right for me as if you were captain and I were crew. I need you to back up, move on, get ghost, and allow me to walk in the glow of my own truth. Moral of this message is, I don't need you. People of the world, I'm your host, GD. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Thursday, the 27th of March. Where did the time go? And it's 1:30 p.m. Raised in New York City's Brooklyn East Projects by his grandparents, Glenda Marsh and Joe Robinson, he called himself the Black Joe Carroll after watching the episodes and liking what he saw. He cites his deadly vows as being action-packed and a literary reflection of personal nightmares and dreams. Speaking for those who are passed on, the ones no one stops to listen to are the individuals that drive his ambitious energy. His connection to the underdog is from a profound love of their existence, especially since he had always been deemed the little guy in the groups he ran with. He is Robert Marsh, the author, and today he has allowed us exclusive access into the mind of his writer. Without further ado, I welcome him to the show. Robert, it is an honor to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. It's an honor to be on the show. Good afternoon to you and to everyone who's listening.
All right. Great, great, great. Well, it's an honor to have you on the show, as I mentioned earlier. And so today, for the next 45 minutes to an hour, it's all about you, and I'm just really grateful that you could do the show today. So there's no better place than to start at the place where it all began. Tell us about your childhood and what life was like growing up in New York City.
Growing up in New York City is rough for anybody, especially young mind, a young wild child such as myself. Basically, my grandmother and grandfather raised me. My father was incarcerated. My mother was sick, and she could not take care of me. So my grandmother adopted me at age 3. And my grandfather and her raised me to be a man. And when I got to a certain age, I ran the streets. I was with one very large gang in New York City. I call it a group on I call it a gang, basically. I was with them. I was running around. I was doing things I had no business doing, but I never got to trouble to the point where I couldn't get out of it.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the things that you did or that you would do while you were in the gang?
Snatch earrings off of women, beat dudes up in the park, rob the opposite gang. I never cut school, never smoked, never drink. So a lot of people, they like that about me because I go do something and go to sleep like it meant nothing to me because at that time, I didn't have no conscience or felt I had a purpose. So, you know, a lot of people who was around me, they always felt that I had their back or I would go out on a limb and, you know, hold them down and make sure they didn't get in no trouble or nothing like that. And if I was always a lookout or something like that. So I did a lot of crazy things I'm not proud of, and I'm glad to have escaped, you know what I'm saying, without any physical scars or wounds or been shot or stabbed like so many of my other friends.
Mm-hmm. And was there something in that life, Robert, was there something in that life that woke you up one day and said, wait a minute, what am I doing?
At the time, no, but what happened was in 2003, my grandmother passed away. And it scared the crap out of me. And, you know, I made the decision to leave New York and move to Charlotte, North Carolina. And to Charlotte, I realized it was really nothing. It was nothing going on at the time. It was a lot of stuff that I had done when I was younger. I'm talking about way before 17, that a lot of kids, a lot of young adults was doing at 18, 19, 20, 21, my own age, around my age. And I saw them doing stuff, and I'm like, nah, this not. It's like I'm running around in my childhood again. But what I realized was the laws was different. In Charlotte, where you had nowhere to run, it's so open, the police would know who did what in a matter of moments to seconds. In New York, it would take them weeks, months, even years to catch up to you, unless you were stupid enough to go out and, you know, advertise, yeah, I did this, yeah, I did that. So that kind of made me look at life and reality differently, and I decided to step back and say, you know what, I like to write. I have a gift. You know, everything is getting watered down and played underneath the table, so let me bring back some reality to industry. And, you know, that's what I'm bringing with Deadly Vows, Raw Emotions, and Living Nightmare, my book, is the reality we all have forgotten about. That, you know, I think, you know, is being blackballed because somebody, whoever is pulling the strings doesn't want the people to have them thoughts and those feelings anymore. I'm trying to bring them back to the front. And I want people to understand that my books are going to be unique. They're going to be a hard read. They're going to be hardcore, but they're going to be genuine. They're going to come from the soul, the gut, the heart. They're not going to come off the top of the mind like some of these other artists are doing now, you know, writing these fantasies and romance novels. No, I'm coming with reality. I lived it. I thought about it. I dreamed about it. I had nightmares about it, so I'm writing about it. And I'm not putting any names or characters in my book because I feel that's dry snitching and that's helping the wrong cause. I'm here just to present my gift to the world as it is. And no matter how much time I have left on this earth, I want to leave my stamp, meaning I want to give back what I've learned to the world and to the next generation, meaning my kids and their kids can sit there and say, wow, this person went through something. I hope I never have to go through what they went through.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what we know so far about you, Robert, as a man, and also a little bit about you as an artist and where your inspiration came from, we know that you were adopted by your grandparents. And so when you were adopted by your grandparents, what was life like within the home with your grandparents? What type of discussions did you have or did they have with you, and did they know that you were in a gang?
No, they didn't. And like I said, most of the time, you know, I didn't bring nothing around my grandmother's apartment. You know, we lived in the project of East New York, but I hung around everywhere from Jersey to Harlem, to the Bronx, to Queens, and I knew different people and stuff. So I hung out in Brooklyn, certain parts far away from where my grandmother lived at, because that really wasn't I didn't want no trouble to come back to her house. So my grandmother never really met any of my friends or girlfriends or, you know, associates or, she, you know, when I came home unharmed, just like I left unharmed, and no scars, nothing new. You know, a couple of hickeys from girlfriends and stuff, but nothing major, you know, nothing physical where I had to be rushed to a hospital, you know, and I was blessed for that I was able to step into the darkness and step out too. But I never forgot, you know, when I was in the darkness, who I was. I never lost sight of, you know, my gifts and my ability and my skill level to teach the world. And a lot of my friends, you know, we used to sit down and talk, and I never really talked to my grandparents the way I talked to my friends, because I believe that they would have thought it was ridiculous, and it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't about school or advancing, you know, in a job, workplace, my grandparents, you know, they was old-fashioned, old-school. They didn't want to hear, you know, what you doing in the streets and stuff like that. The only thing my grandmother ever told me, a couple of things my granddaddy and grandma ever told me was, make sure you keep clean socks, drawers, and make sure clean T-shirt, and don't get no girl pregnant. That's it. And don't catch no STDs. That's it.
Just the basics. You know, when as you were talking, what popped into my head was the movie Menace to Society, starring Lorenz Tate. And I know that the character Kane was played, I can't remember that actor's name, but he also was in Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation video as the anguished youngster that was in it. So that kind of is what it reminds me of when you're talking about, you know, your existence with your grandparents. And I could definitely relate to just the very basics because, you know, I guess from that era, you know, sex was never talked about, the communication wasn't as good as it should be. So we wind up going out in the streets and learning some of the wrong things. So the question I have for you, and I'm wondering, was your grandmother one who took you to church or got you involved in other activities?
No, we wasn't a big church-going type people. My grandmother went to church a couple of times herself, but it, you know what I'm saying? When you work in, I'll say 48 to 50 hours a week, you know, and, you know, and my grandfather, he worked too. He was building metal iron doors for the projects in Brooklyn, all over throughout Brooklyn. A church is like, Saturday and Sunday is like your days to relax. It's like, I'm retired from the job. I ain't got to go back to Monday. So church really wasn't, you know, it wasn't on the first menu to do, even though it should have been. I mean, I rarely went to church. You know what I'm saying? My grandmother rarely went to church. So as far as activities go and stuff like that, really wasn't into none of the, like, stuff that a lot of my, well, actually, it really wasn't until I got older, I started, you know, liking to walk and listen to music and write and lift weights and play a little bit of basketball and stuff. So it was later on down the line I got myself into it, but then that couldn't hold my mind, you know what I'm saying, to the point of where, you know, I saw other things going on and I was a part of other factors because it was so much to do in New York City and, you know, you only got one life. So, you know, you young, you trying to run through the ranks and, you know, do everything. You know, I can remember one day it was pouring down rain and a girl had called me around 3 o'clock in the morning. I jumped up, put my clothes on, and got dressed and ran to her, you know, and it was just so much I was doing I shouldn't have been doing. If I can go back and change it all, I probably wouldn't, because that's what made me a stronger person. I know, okay, so I know more now than I did when I was running around.
And that's a good thing, because as we get older, we're supposed to learn from our mistakes. So the question that I have for you about that 3 a.m. booty call, I guess I would call it a booty call. So when you left out of the house, were you ever questioned by your grandparents or talked to about leaving, or were they just so asleep they didn't know?
No, my grandmother knew. She was like, Robert, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Are you really going to that girl's house? I'm like, yeah. And she was like, well, just be safe. And, you know, like I said, did you change your underwear? Yes. Okay, you got condoms? Yes. So she knew what I was doing. She just kept indented. Don't get nobody pregnant. Don't get no STD. You know, if you're going to a dangerous neighborhood and I'm trying to tell you not to, but you're going to do what you want to do, just have a change of underwear and socks and make sure you got deodorant on or something, your teeth been brushed, just God forbid something happened to you. You know, and, you know, that was the attitude growing up in Brooklyn for, I think, all the children, because you're not guaranteed life. The cost of life in New York is real cheap. You know what I'm saying? It'll be a Monday, and you'll be dead Tuesday, and nobody will remember you by Thursday. So it was the cost of life in New York are real cheap. And, you know what I'm saying, that's why everything is so precious. But to who loves you and who knows you and who cares about you, but the cost of life from one individual to another individual is so cheap. Nobody cares about nobody. Everybody's trying to get to the top. Everybody's trying to be the best at this, be the best at that. Who's trying to be a super thug or an OG, a triple OG? And nobody cares about life. You know, when you're in that state of mind, you ain't thinking about, oh, let me get myself together and work on my career. You know, you're thinking about, you know, let me make this money. Let me hit these girls up. Let me do this. Let me do that. You know, nobody worry about the aftermath of things. They worry about the moment. And that's how I was living, for the moment.
I definitely understand that. So what I would like to try to get a visual here. Now, I know back in the late 70s, my sister, my brother, and I were put on a plane, and we got into Kennedy Airport, and my grandmother, my father's mother, had a barbecue restaurant there, and she lived in the Bronx, New York. And what I remember about that as a young child, first of all, that was around the time that black exploitation films were out. So you had Johnny Tough, and you had Trouble Man, and you had all of these. But what I remember about the Bronx is that, you know, there's one building that is standing, and then in the next lot, there's nothing but a bunch of bricks where another building was. So it was almost like, from what I remember, a post-apocalyptic experience. So was Brooklyn the same way? And if so, what is the landscape now like? Have you gone back to New York to kind of check it out?
I haven't been back in a while, but I know last time I was there, knuckleheads is still knuckleheads, and it still looks wild and crazy. And the Bronx, you know, the Bronx ain't changed. You know, like I didn't say, you can bring in any type of factor you want—white, black, Hispanic, and things—unless they're gonna tear everything down and rebuild into houses and stuff. You can't change just because you bring a race in or ethics or stuff. Brooklyn's going to be Brooklyn. The Bronx is going to be the Bronx. The Bronx, I'm sure, you know, is still run by the Latin Kings and the Necktie's. And if you come across the wrong person at the wrong time, they'll cut your face. And, you know, and I'm sure Brooklyn is still ran by the Crips and the Bloods, and especially the Bloods and the Gorilla family and the BMF family. So it's like, you know, I know it ain't changed. East New York is still East New York. Pink houses is still houses, Brownsville is still Brownsville, Brookline is still Brookline. You just get older, new people move in, and the same old stuff continues.
Wow, that's pretty sad. I actually want to go to New York to visit just to kind of see Times Square. And, you know, especially when you're talking about, you know, the author experience, you know, the most support that I've been given, there are certainly authors here, but the East Coast is a very relatively rich in culture and also into literary and also the Broadway stuff. So I'm looking forward to going there. So the question that I have for you now, Robert, is why do you think, or have you ever thought about why you were spared the consequences from some of your actions?
I just, you know, now looking back at it, you know, my grandmother was alive, my grandfather alive, but they were still my angels watching over me, you know, and I think that, you know, their input in my life, it just made me know when to pull out and when to go out, you know what I'm saying? Because a lot of people that I knew, they went out at the wrong time, and then when I went out the next day, I hear they got locked up, you know? And like I said, a lot of things, I just think God had a different plan for me. He let me be a knucklehead. He let me do the things that he know I'm not supposed to be doing, but he also said these are life lessons. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say I've been locked up too now. I ain't got nothing on my records from New York City because I never got charged with anything. But I have been locked up, and I had, you know, but it was nothing serious to hit my record. I was a juvenile. And like I said, I think everything happens for a reason. Now, when you get locked up, you have a choice. You have a choice. You can either take it as a lesson and learn from your mistakes, or you can sit here and do the same dumb thing again and get locked up for longer periods of time. I learn from my mistakes. That's one thing that my grandmother and grandfather installed in me. I knew how not to get caught like I did the first time. So if I did something again, I knew how to clean it up in a matter of time before the police or someone snitched or somebody saw me, you know, doing this. I knew how to get away instead of standing around the same neighborhood and being the only one who looked like a person who just, you know, robbed this guy or snatched this chain or pocketbook. So I knew how to escape that by hopping on the train and getting out of Dodge.
Well, I applaud you for that, and I also applaud you for your courage to understand that you wanted a better life for yourself. And I think that I've had like a couple of guys on, more than a couple of guys that, again, you know, were incarcerated, but when they emerge from the system, they actually emerge with a new perspective on how life, their life was going to be run. either because they had children that they were raising, and a couple of them are raising their child alone, contrary to what people believe. You know, there are men that actually raise their children as well, because some women can be just as trifling as a trifling man. So we all have wreckage from the past that we had to clear up before we could move forward. Have you cleaned up all of your wreckage, or are you still working on it?
My wreckage is basically clean. You know, I'm going straight, you know, for the rest of my life. I'm not trying to get caught up in nothing, do nothing to bring shame to my grandmother and grandfather or my children's names, you know what I'm saying? I'm basically just going straight forward. You know, I'm not looking for trouble no more. You know, I got two kids of my own, so I want them. I don't want them to grow up having to watch their back because of stupid stuff I did.
Okay, I think that's very noble of you, and I'm very proud of you. So let's talk about this move. Okay, so you were in New York, and we know that New York is the concrete jungle. So you moved out to one of the Carolinas. So what was did you have family out in Carolina, or did you just go because you wanted to get away from New York?
No, like I said, my grandmother had passed away. My uncle was already down here, and he got married and stuff, and he came down here and stuff. So I figured, well, what harm could it be to go down there, you know what I'm saying, and check out the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say I hate it. I'm not going to say I love it. I'm just right now, I'm new, it's neutral. You know, I've been here since 2006. Yes, I would love to go back to New York on better terms as and when is possible. But for right now, Charlotte has my vote. You know, it's a nice city, you know. If you about something, you can get somewhere in Charlotte. But if you are a knucklehead, you come from Compton or Watts or Houston, Texas, or New York or Chicago, Tennessee, and you want to be stupid, you all get locked up real quick down here. Because the police down here don't play. They don't care. You know, they just, it's like their way or the highway, and that's just the way they roll. So I learned that, you know, quick, fast, and in a hurry by watching people get locked up for nothing, basically, you know, standing on the corner. You know, you can, trespassing is two trespassing charges in Charlotte is a felony. And it's crazy, because I'm like, wow, really? Breaking an entry, you know, when you invade somebody's house, it's a felony now. And I'm like, really? Because I know in New York it was never no felony. And when I first came to Charlotte, it wasn't a felony. But a friend of mine's in Charlotte, he had a couple of years ago broken somebody's house, and they told him that he had to do 5 years. It's a felony. And I was like, seriously? And I, you know what I'm saying? That word felony can crush a lot of people, man. It can, you know, it messes up your life because you can't get work, you can't do this, you can't do that. And it just puts you in the hole.
Yeah, I saw something that was very alarming. Someone posted it on Facebook, where the largest percentage of inmates are black, you know, and many believe that the laws were designed. I know what the caption said. It said that there are more black men incarcerated than there were back during the slavery days. And I think that is a very alarming statistic. That is a reality. And so, once again, Robert, what I want to say, I'm glad that I got you on this show to let you know that people do care. You know, I'm an older guy, and my thing is for this show is to actually showcase not only established artists such as the Howard Hewitt interview and some of the other people that I've done, but also to give a platform to upcoming artists to let them know that people really do care and are applauding their work. So before we leave your youth, I just have one more question, and then we'll move on into your literary life. What are some of the fondest memories you have about your youth?
Just my grandmother's cooking, my grandmother's knowledge, and my grandfather's toughness and what he installed in me, you know. I mean, I used to get kicked out of school, suspended, and I get a spanking. And I, you know, when you growing up, you get those beatings. You mad? You wonder why? You say you will never do it to your kids. But then, when you get older, you're thankful for them beatings because then you look at your kids. You be like, man, this how I was, and it's like 10 times worse because you haven't really matured into a father figure man type yet. But your mental has to be there for your child. And it's like when I look at my son and my daughter, I sense myself 10. And it's like they be doing sneaky stuff that they don't have to do, but they do it just to see what I'm going to say and what I'm going to do and how I'm going to react. And when I punish them, I sit back and I think, I said to myself, I said, now I know what my grandmother meant about, you know, I was hard-headed, I'm going to learn. Because when I look at my own kids, I realize I see a lot of myself in her and how I discipline my kids. So I'm grateful for the beings I got, the punishment, the knowledge, the backbone. You know, I think in my family, you know, so to speak, I might have the strongest spirit and essence out of everybody else. And being that I'm adopted, it made it, you know, it made it like 10 times stronger because it's like, okay, you know, my grandmother is basically my father's mother. So when she adopted me, I'm her third son, basically, and her grandson. So it's like, you know, certain people, when they found this out, Not family members, but, you know, when I'm in school and stuff, they used to teach, oh, you just adopted. And that got me to more fights and stuff, but it also made me stronger. It made me want more. It made me want to hunt and become a stronger person because you got that title of being adopted, but you know you also her grandson by blood, and now you're her son through adoption. So it just made me stronger. And the way they raised me was to never let words break you, just keep focus on what you believe in and what you're going to do with your life. Don't let nobody come between what your plans and motivation is. Let no man separate what you create, and that's how I live my life.
I think it's incredible, and I think that it's wonderful that you realize the gift that you had in your grandparents. And so you had mentioned about your mother. I wanted to ask this question. So you remember that you mentioned that your mother was ill. Is she still with us, or did she pass on?
She's still with us. When I say ill, I mean my mother basically chose the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not grateful that she did that. But yes, when I finally got to meet her and see her, she admitted that she was sick. You know, she said she couldn't help herself. And that's something else that made me strong for this woman to accept her fault and understand that, you know, even though she's my mother, my biological mother and gave birth to me, she knew that my grandmother was my mother who raised me, you know, and that was my mother in all aspects of life, you know what I'm saying? My mother knew she had very little, next to none influence in my life, so she really couldn't tell me anything other than the fact that she was sorry and that she was sick. You know, she had her own problems, her own issues, and she couldn't deal with pressure. And, you know, like they said, pressure bust pipes, and her pipes and was never strong enough anyway. So I was proud that she was able to admit that she was weak and that she wished she could have did things differently. But then she also said that she's glad that I turned out to be a strong young man. And I'm grateful for that. Like I said, when I say ill, I don't mean, you know, I just mean she's mentally ill. Like she just couldn't gather her thoughts and her strengths enough. She let her demons eat her up. And you know what I'm saying?
We
all do.
Yeah,
in different ways.
Yeah, I do. And that reminds me of the movie Find Antoine Fisher, and where he actually goes back to meet his mother. And his mother is living in a project, and he wants her to see because he wants to understand why. I don't know if he came to the conclusion, sort of like you did, that, you know, that some people just aren't strong. It doesn't matter if they've had babies or whatever. Some of them just aren't. But, you know, the way that we grow and combat the adversity, we actually go ahead and move on and forgive and just learn to not make the same mistakes that they did. So I just sent a prayer out for your mom, and I hope that she kind of comes to a better understanding of herself and a better existence in life, because life is tough, like you said. And so you have your two kids, and what we're going to talk about now is what led you into the literary ring.
I've always been a beast with the pen. You know, I can talk to anybody about any subject, but when it comes down to writing, it's just something special. It's like Tupac Shakur on the mic. It's like Biggie Smalls or wax, you know. It's something special. You have to live it. You have to read it. You have to understand it. And when you read it, you know what I'm saying, it's like, wow, you know, I bring the unique gift that most artists don't. You know, I speak about what CNN and Fox News is scared to tell you about, and that's the truth. So, you know, I feel that my life, you know, however long it lasts, I feel that it was given to me. I survived through so much. Why not give back? That's where a lot of people lose focus at. They don't never give back. They just think, this is for me. This is mine. No, you are given this platform. You did those things. You survived those things. Now you got this. It's a platform. Share your experiences with the world. Share your knowledge. Share your whether it was drug sales, gun shootouts, bullet wounds, scars, stabbings, jail, prison. Share that with the world. Some way, somehow, you have to release that. You can't take it with you. And that's why I came into writing, because it was like I would see things in school that would make me angry. You know what I'm saying? I would do things outside in the streets that would leave me thinking. And I'd write down everything, but I could never really, you know, go into depth of what I saw, what I was thinking, because it'd get me in trouble. So, you know, at my age, I was young then. So then I realized how to twist it and metamorph my words and sentences into stuff without people actually decoding it. So that's why, you know, that's what brought me into the business of writing and stuff. But I didn't publish my books and stuff until I came to Charlotte and I had time to think, relax, and go through an emotional roller coaster and settle down and gather all my thoughts and, you know, put that pen to paper and, you know, my mind, you know, it's like God touches my mind whenever I'm writing. It's like he's like, focus, you know, he's massaging my brain, and I just can't stop.
I like how you explain that. You've got incredible insight, and it's certainly wonderful that you were actually able to channel your beginning and channel it into something that is positive that will inspire and touch other people. So the question I have is, can you tell us a little bit about your earlier writings and elaborate on how you finessed your skills as a writer to become a published author of the book Deadly Vows?
My earlier writings was, it wasn't, it, nothing I do, nothing my, when I write, nothing I ever do is just scratch or chicken scratch or scrub or whatever you want to cut. It always has had a meaning. But it was too poisonous for the world at that present point in time. So what I had to do was I had to find a way to say what I had to say without people decoding it so easily. So if I had a problem with the way a tree looked it or a teacher wore her dress, instead of saying the teacher's name and the dress she wore, I would talk about her in the form of a garbage can or a long stick or a pole, and I would talk about how I wrapped the colors of her dress, not the dress itself, the colors of her dress she had on that I saw that day that she wore that dress around the pole. If you understand what I'm saying,
I'm following you. The point that you made, and I think that is a very profound statement that you just made, that the work just in its raw state is too poisonous for the world at that time. So you actually channel it by using metaphors. Is that what you're saying, metaphors to describe the situations? Okay.
Yes.
I got
it. And see, basically what I do is, like, if I'm having a problem, you know what I'm saying, I decode my own work and then I rewrite it, like you said, using metaphors and different things. That way no one else can decode it. Like, when people ask me about my book, Deadly Vows itself, I could tell them anything, you know, because I'm the author. It's up to the readers and the fans to decode it in their way. But see, what I do is, so I don't confuse them and I don't make them stray away, what I do is I give them some input. I tell them, I said, have you ever had a bad day? And 90% of the people that I speak to is women. They're like, yeah. Have you ever hated a man so bad? Read this story. Read this book. And recent, last last summer I met, you know, I'm not a big, I don't go to strip clubs or nothing, but I met some dancers and stuff on a train. And I gave them my book. At first they was like, I like to know what you like to read. You know, and they was like, well, like romance novels and stuff, and I like to know why. And they talking about because it helps us forget about our job. And, you know, I understand that. But once you finish fantasizing, what you got to do? You got to go back to work.
Right.
So I gave one of the young ladies, I had an extra book on me at the time. I gave it to her. And they got off the train or whatever the case may be. And I explained it before they left. She asked me, well, what is this? I said, that's my book, Deadly Vows. And she was like, it looked kind of spooky and scary. I said, no, it's a unique tale. You know, everybody looks at the cover and the back cover and says, oh, you are crazy. And you know what? I'm going to tell you the truth. I am crazy. But that's not what you're reading. You're reading reality. If I'm crazy for believing in reality and reality is off the chain for believing in me, then I guess, you know, we're both on the right path. So I explained that to this young lady. You know what I'm saying? They took the book. They left. This past New Year's, I seen the ladies with, you know, their friends. And I asked them, I said, how y'all ladies doing? They said, who are you? I said, I gave you the book on the train that day. And I didn't think they was going to remember when I said that. And they was like, oh, yeah, you the guy who wrote that book. That's what we was all talking about. They've been talking about the book for the last couple of months since I gave it to them. They said the young lady who I gave the book to, she quit stripping, and she went and started the job and went back to school. And
Wait a minute. I gotta repeat that again. So the one of the women who actually read the book, was it a result of reading the book that she changed her life?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And the thing about it is, when I was talking to the ladies on New Year's, I was like, well, what about the rest of y'all? You know what I'm saying? I said, well, where does she work? She work at Wendy's, and she goes to CPCC, which is a community college in Charlotte. And I asked, you know, I said, well, what about the rest of y'all? And they all like, we're reading your book, and we're talking about it and stuff like that, and we're trying to find out what made her change. And they talked to the girl still, and whatever the case may be. And I saw the girl last month at the community college. And me and her sat down for about an hour or 2 hours, and we talked about the book. And she was like, you know what changed my life? And she said she'll never forget that I can relate to her in so many ways. Like, I bring misery out when I'm writing, but I also bring positive notion, being that you don't want to live this life. Because if you're going to – she was like, she was stripping, and the book was constantly on her mind, and she couldn't really get into her dance movements, because she said it's cool to make $3,000 a night, but is it worth your safety? Is it worth your life? And she thought about it, and she just – she never went back. She said, because of my book, because I was so inspiring in a miserable, negative form, it turned out to be a positive thing and a positive outlook for her and her friends. Now, her friends, she said she's trying to get them to quit the stripping and stuff like that, but they are, you know, they are so used to a certain lifestyle that it's going to be hard for them to cut back to what she's like. You can keep that lifestyle. I can keep my life and keep my soul and grow as a real woman, a steady doing what I know was not meant for me to be doing in the first place. So Deadly Vows has a unique poison to it, but it also has that same poison is positive. You know, it's crazy, it's dark, it's murderous. But on the flip side of things, if you're out there already living that life and you know somebody who's writing about it and who's lived it, you're like, well, wait a minute, if this guy has done it, been locked up, and now he's speaking about it, maybe we can do something, you know, other than this.
All right. Well, you know what? For the listeners out there who have tuned in, the call-in number is 347-215-7169, and if you press 1, you'll be added to the queue, and I'm going to take some calls before we finish the segment today. So you're listening to a young man by the name of Robert Marsh, who channeled anger, you know, oranges from a gang. He recovered from the loss of his grandmother. He actually decided to turn his life around for the better. He even had experienced bouts of incarceration. But he emerged, and he has two children of his own, and he wrote a book called Deadly Vows. And what he just told us is that there were some strippers he met on a train, and as a result of a couple of them reading that book, it changed their life. So for anyone listening, the power of literary, especially when it's anointed by God, it does actually change lives. And so we're going to go back, and I'm going to ask a question about Deadly Vows. Deadly Vows, Robert Marsh, can you tell us about the storyline, the concept? What is the concept for Deadly Vows? What is it? Is it an insight about a man for a woman, or can you elaborate on it for us?
It's an insight about everybody. You know, it really does. It has a purpose. It has a plot. It has a beginning. It has a middle, and it has an end. It's not focused on one person's life, demise, or uprise. It's just a movement to bring reality to the forefront and bring the truth out. You know, things happen to people. They don't talk about it. They hold it in. Deadly Vows is something that happens to everybody. Everybody takes it in as vows, and it blows up in their mind, and they do crazy stuff. So Deadly Vows is basically your release point. If you didn't want to release, you know, your anger, I released it for you. If you want to keep that secret because you felt this way, I wanted to share that emotion that you were feeling. You know, Deadly Vows have so many twists and turns, you're really never able to actually pinpoint who he's talking about, because if you read from page 1 to 100, it's basically emotions that everybody feels and has gone through. And each story just pulls you in because it's so unique and rare that you have that today. All you have today is mostly romance novels, which is fake and fantasy. You have these cartoon novels, which is cartoonish, and they teach you the wrong stuff. You have these wannabes this, these wannabes that, who put this stuff out just to get, you know, a dollar and some change off of you. And people buy into it because they don't want to express that raw emotion that they're so used to, that they don't want to relive their painful past. But Deadly Vows is not making you relive it. It's making you release it. Like, wow, you know, I read this book. Man, somebody went through something like I went through. I understand where they're coming from. You know, I feel better now. I thought I was the only one in this world who felt this way. You know, and it's like, you know, it tears you up when you read it because you're like, where is this person going? But then when you listen to, you know what I'm saying, your music or you're reading this book, it's not where I'm going. It's where you've been. It's where you've been hurt at.
Well, you know what? In the summary, and I'm understanding exactly what this book is about. In the summary, you talk about the demons inside all of us. Now, hold on to that question because I want to get an understanding of what you meant when you cited that. So bear with me just a moment. I'm going to talk about some upcoming shows. For those who have tuned in, we are with the author, Robert Marsh, the author of Deadly Vows. And what I'm going to do now is talk about upcoming shows. Tomorrow, the 28th, Destiny meets Grace as author Destiny Carter steps into the den of Grace to discuss her literary expression. Next, on Saturday at 1:30 p.m., I have poet Donovan Brown, who will join us to discuss his poetic persuasion and creativity. And then on Thursday, now get this, you guys, he sold 5,000 books as a self-published author, and his name is Michael McGrew. And he is just, for as long as I've known Michael, he has just always been a very busy young man. So that's going to be on the 3rd of April at 1:30 p.m. 5,000 is nothing to sneeze at. So now I'm going to go back to the author of the hour, and that is Robert Marsh. I want to talk about the demons inside all of us. So the question that I have, what is a reality within Deadly Vows that addresses the demon inside all of us?
Basically, the reality is like the emotions. You know, like, okay, with men, it's hard to tell because, you know, men supposedly only cry when they're alone at night. Supposedly, you know, real men don't cry, so they say. But with women, you know, women go through, you know, period forms. They go through, you know, menstruation. They go through first love. They go through divorces. So the demons that I'm speaking about is all of this combined, you know, men and women, the struggle that they go through, you know what I'm saying, what women feel, what men feel that they don't want to discuss. The reality is the fear of discussing it. You know, people, my book is not to be feared and disliked. It's to be feared and understood. And that's why, you know what I'm saying, it's a unique sell, because most people read that book and they're like, they have a million questions to ask me, you know, whether I'm on Facebook, whether I'm on Twitter. You know, they want to know, made you write Deadly Vows. You know, I fear this book, and I fear the type of person that you are and the type of writer you are, and my demons come out because I'm reading this book, and my husband or my wife or my girlfriend or my fiance, they be looking at me sideways with sour looks, and we be at the dinner table, and they get mad over the simplest thing. And one husband, he had asked, he said, please don't write no books like this no more. My wife bought your book. We at the dinner table, and I had done something stupid. And I was trying to apologize, and she said, she got up, she threw her food on the floor, she slammed, said, read this book, and then apologize to me. And he read the book, and I didn't think he was going to do it. He told me he read the book, and then he got angry at himself. Like, I didn't know men do stupid things like this, and I'm really sorry. And he was telling me his story, and, you know, I can't give his name out, and I'm not going to give his, you know, all his business out, but he read the book, and he said, don't write nothing like this, because me and my wife now, we're so emotional, you know, so many ideas and past aggressions and arguments is coming up, and it brings the truth out of people like liquor. You know, when you drink, you start telling the truth. But this book probably does that to some people, and then some people, it makes them scared to know that there's a person that's inside my head, and I don't even know who this person is. And women have that, really... Go ahead.
That's heavy. You know what? This book has got to be a good read. You're talking about, you know, women having read the book, and then they're looking sideways at their mate, and they're thinking, is this what you think? I'm getting it now. It's almost like you're disclosing the secrets of men. And I like how you said, it's like liquor. When people drink that liquor, they bring out the truth. So let's talk about your creative process for this book. What was the climate like in the room? Was the light dim? Did you have candles? Was it music? And how long did it take to write this book?
Actually, I wrote the book in 2 weeks.
Wow.
I wrote the book in 2 weeks. I was actually going through some problems myself. And I go to the library, and in the cubicle, I just wrote, you know, nonstop, you know, every day, you know. And then I submitted it, and it was out. November the first, 2006.
Mm-hmm. And did you self publish?
It was. I'm an indie author. It was published through Author House Publishing. Basically, I am self published, but it's / indie published. So I'm an indie author / self publisher. You know, and that's, you know, self author. And
it sounds like an intriguing book. And one reason why I feel that it is a great read is because you're genuine. And that, as an artist, is the big point. It's on any plane, from a painter to a singer to a sculptor. You know, when you put honesty and passion behind the art, it becomes very compelling. So what I want to do is I want to take a call or two. So hold on just a moment, and let's see if someone has a question for you today. So 314-707, you are on with author G.D. Grace and Robert Marsh. Do you have a question? Okay. All right, so let's try one more. 919-753, you are on with G.D. and Robert Marsh. Do you have a question?
Yes. Hello, my name is Amanda, and I'd like to ask Robert, why do you carry so much rage?
I carry a lot of rage myself, or in my books, you mean?
I guess within yourself that comes out in your books.
Okay, I carry a lot of rage because things I saw in life was very unfair, and I went through a lot of emotional, stressful times myself, and a lot of times I was alone with my own thoughts, and it might sound kind of spooky, but I spoke to myself, and I also, I'm not trying to sound weirded out, but I also, you know, answered questions. I asked questions to myself, and I answered them, too, and I also, like, listen to the voices in my head that told me that everybody hates you, you're a loner, you're dull, you're odd. And, you know what I'm saying, I know a lot of people who live like that, but I was one to live like that and survive it, and I'm just bringing it back, you know, to the front of the line to let people know, listen, you're not alone. You know, I still have a lot of emotional problems inside my soul and heart. But slowly but surely, I'm releasing them. So when I write down stuff, it's not that I'm enraged at that moment. It's that I want to express what I was feeling when I was like this. And I want other people to start looking at their children and asking questions like, are you feeling a certain type of way when I punish you? What went through your mind? Because when I got beaten and punished, trust and believe, somebody out in the streets was going to pay for it. You know, I might have took that loss right then and there, but when I got free, it was gonna be some hard hits and behind whoopers I gave out, and that's just, you know, how I thought about things. Now I'm older and I'm more or less in the world, and you know, I'm seeing a lot of cartoon stuff. I'm like, well, wait a minute, I don't want to go that route. I want to open up doors and show people the truth. Like, when you discipline your children and they might be right or wrong, maybe you need to talk to them as well. When you don't discipline your children, you don't think your children do anything wrong, but years later they end up in prison, maybe you need to question yourself. And that's what I did when I was alone. I questioned myself. I was very angry. You know, when growing up, you know, people talked about my mother not being in my life, my father not being in my life, and I held a lot of that in. So now that I got the platform to express it and talk about it and write about it, I'm doing so. It might come off negative to some, but it's coming out positive to me in my eyes, in my view, how I'm expressing myself to people.
Did that answer your question, Amanda?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, you know what, Amanda? I want to say thank you so much for supporting the show and for calling in and talking to the author. You know, it just means a lot when support is given. So I really want to say thank you so much for that, and do spread the word about A Touch of Grace. And also, if you know anybody that wants to come on the show, hit me up, okay?
I will, and I appreciate you having Robert on the show. He has a great book.
Yes, he does. Thank you so much for calling in, darling. You take care.
Okay, you too.
Okay. I like how you explained that. You answered the question, and I really appreciate her for calling in. So we might have a time for one more. Let's go ahead and try it. 989-739, you are on with GD and author Robert Marsh. Do you have a question? Okay. All right. So we had a good question that came up, and one I want to say, Robert, is I encourage you to keep on going, you know, and at this particular point in time, is there anything inside that wants you to do a sequel to Deadly Vows?
Everybody wants me to do a sequel to Deadly Vows. Everybody's telling me to do a sequel to Deadly Vows. The reason why I say yes sometimes, but I think no, is because I think Deadly Vows is a classic. I don't want to do a remake. I don't want to water it down. I do want to let people know that the next thing that you might love next to Deadly Vows will be Raw Emotions, my book that's on Kindle for $2.99 on Amazon. But Deadly Vows is a classic. It's like, you know how they just did RoboCop and they watered it down and they messed it up? I think Deadly Vows is the first RoboCop that ever came out, and I think I wanna leave it there the way it is instead of coming out with all these remixes and remakes and Deadly Vows 2 and Deadly Vows 3, because I think it's a unique book. And I think that uniqueness would get watered down if I did Deadly Vows 2, the sequel, or Deadly Vows 3. But don't ever count out that I might do it. Because I might, you know, I might wake up, you know, I'll say next week and write a book called Deadly Vows 2. It just might not have the same poisonous attitude, vengefulness, and that's what I'm scared of. I don't want to stray away from that in another book and call it Deadly Vows Part 2 when it doesn't match the first one. And that's where a lot of artists mess up at. And then, like I didn't say, a lot of artists also do they also do Part 2 trying to get their units up too, because, and you know what I'm saying, they water down the first book and then they lose fan base. So I don't want to do that. I want to sit here and Deadly Vows and Roy Emotions and Living Nightmare, let those you know, hang in the sky, you know, let them titles, you know, make its own history. You know, and let me move on to the next and put more stuff out there, positive, negative, however my fan base wants it. Don't get me wrong, I might want one day write Deadly Vows too, but I'm scared because I don't want to water down Deadly Vows, the original. And,
all right, what I want you to do is I want you to think about a question. I'm going to go ahead and thank some people. So while I'm doing these thank yous, I want you to think about if you were allowed to travel back in time, what you would tell 7-year-old Robert Morris. So hold on to that, and let me go ahead and get these thank yous out, okay? Robert?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, cool. So hold that thought, think about that, and I'm going to come back to you for an answer. So I'd like to give a special shout-out to my friends over at World Media, in particular Mr. Wayne Barros, for bridging the gap and sending some great guests over to A Touch of Grace. As you may know, that Cornell and Brown joined us a few weeks ago to talk about the upcoming film based on the gangster's daughter, Francine Lucas. And so her father was Frank Lucas, who was portrayed by Denzel Washington in the movie American Gangster. And on that same bill, Davey O'Lee Project was with us, along with the ladies of DLP, and World Media made that happen. I'd like to also extend thank yous out to Yvette Brown over at Extravagant Entertainment for making the Howard Hewitt interview happen in February. And because of that, the interviews we have coming up are going to even be greater. So Howard Hewitt was great. These are going to be great as well. So I want to thank my friends over at both of those establishments. And now I'm going to go back to the author of the hour to get an answer to that question. Time machine travel, you're 7 years old. What would you tell your 7-year-old self?
I basically would tell my 7-year-old self to keep pace with what he's doing, just control it much more than you did before. Just control it, because I'm telling you, I look at my life, and like I said, 7 years old, my son is 7 now. So when I see him doing things that I used to do 10 times worse, I tell him, you need to just calm down. You're doing it right. You're learning, but you're also making bigger boo-boos than you have to. And what I would do with my 7-year-old self, if I can go back, I'm 31 now, and if I can go back and tell my 7-year-old self something, it would be, go forward with what you're doing. Just learn from your mistakes quicker. Just learn from your mistakes quicker, because I don't regret nothing I did in my life. I just felt that, you know what I'm saying, some things I could have avoided, some fights I couldn't avoid it. Some people I could have avoided, you know what I'm saying? Mm. Some incidents I didn't have to do. So I would tell my 7-year-old self, you're fine. But on this day and on this date and when you're this age, you might want to stray away from these type of people. And that's what mm-hmm. I do. That's what I tell my son, and he's 7 years old. I tell him, you're doing good. You're wilding out. You're enjoying your life. You're playing. You're having fun. You might want to watch who's around you. You know, observe your surroundings. And I try to tell him, and he asks me, what does that mean? And I tell him, just look around you. Is these the people you want around you right now? Is this who you want to play with? Is this who you want to befriend right now? And that's what I would tell my 7-year-old self. Look around you. You're 7. She's 15. He's 10. He's 11. He's, you know, 9. You know, do you want them kind of people around you? Because what they're going to teach you? You know, you're basically leading them at 7. So, you know, you have to pick and choose, you know, what battles to fight. And that's what I would teach my 7-year-old self, like I'm teaching my 7-year-old son. You can't go out and you hang with older people and you're their leader. They're supposed to have some type of guidance over you. But, you know, we all think differently. So that's what I would teach my 7-year-old son.
All right. Well, what I want to say is thank you for doing the show. You are now part of the alumni, and when you have another book out or you want to touch bases with your fans, you always have a key open to the show. So I want to say thank you so much for doing the show, and I'm going to let you go back to your afternoon, and thank you once again, Robert.
Okay, it was my pleasure, and I hope everybody goes and gets Deadly Vows on Amazon. It's a unique read. It's powerful, motivating. It's scary. It's dark. It's light. It's everything you want from a real author of today's watered-down world.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. You go ahead and enjoy your afternoon, okay?
Okay, you do the same.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, everybody, it's a wrap, but, you know, I always like to leave you with a little bit of something, a little food for the thought, food for the soul. It's called We Can Never Lie to Ourselves. The road ahead is filled with exciting opportunities, travel, and, interestingly, successful people. It took years for me to realize that my spirit is just as intriguing as the next person. Lip service is mouth-moving action from an open mouth spouting off empty words. Can be. It really used to hurt my feelings, but one day you wake up and discover that those who really matter, who mean you well, are the only ones that count. I no longer chase friendships. I chase dreams. Just by being me, I am meeting some of the most interesting intellects and sincere individuals. The price of their friendship, free of charge. The terms of their friendship, encouragement, and inspiration. I had no idea I had issues with trust, but once I identified another culprit anchoring my spirit down, I documented those feelings, addressed them, and emerged from that mental impairment. Mental freedom requires a deep investment in self. It also requires an open mind. Change only occurs when there is a strong faith and virginal desire. We may be able to lie to others, but one thing I know for sure, we can never lie to ourselves. So with that in mind, again, I want to thank my author, the author that came through. He was fantastic. Definitely go out and support his work. His name is Robert Marsh, and I'd like to say this. Know that GD loves you. Please do make sure you're loving yourself. All right? Take care.